everyone. Welcome to Overcoming Codependency, a journey to self-love and healthy relationships. I am your host, Andy Anderson, co-founder of Avaya. And thank you so much for joining us for this really extraordinary event. We are talking with authors, psychologists, therapists, doctors, and more. And they are sharing really powerful stories, personal stories, insights, tools, strategies to help people who are struggling with codependency truly love and be themselves and experience healthy, loving relationships. And today, our guest is going to talk about codependency, self-esteem, and your inner gold. And that guest is none other than Dr. Dean Robb. Thanks for being with us, Dr. Robb.
Sure. I'm happy to be here.
I'm excited to have you here. I want to share a little bit about you, and then I'll dive into our first question. So Dr. Robb has a master's degree in human development and a doctorate in human and organizational development. He has been in recovery for over 30 years, and he's been coaching for the last 6 years. And people come to Dr. Robb who are in recovery from addiction, codependency, and now they're dealing with some deeper issues stemming from childhood dysfunction, abuse, and trauma. So, Dr. Robb, could you just start us off by telling us what is codependency?
Sure, absolutely. At root, codependency is an adaptation or survival strategy that is used or created by children. They're growing up in dysfunctional, abusive, traumatic environments. It is basically the way they learn to survive in that environment. In a healthy family, the parents are there to take care of the child. Seems very simple, doesn't it? And to mirror to the child who that child really is, so that the child can grow up knowing who they are and learning more and more about who they are in a safe, basically just in a safe, healthy context where they're not shamed, they're loved, they are esteemed, and that's how they grow up that way. If you think about people with very, very high self-esteem, one comes to mind right now, strangely, Duke Ellington, who had an extraordinary high self-esteem. He was raised in an atmosphere where he was, in his words, adored by his parents.
Could you say the name one more time? You cut out a little bit when you said it. So what was the name?
Duke Ellington.
Okay, thank you.
Jazz orchestra leader.
Got it.
But in dysfunctional families, basically the roles are reversed. The children are there to take care of the parent. The parent is unable to meet the emotional needs of the child because they are themselves too wounded and dysfunctional to really take care of the child. And so what happens is the child starts to take care of the parent. The parent also is usually abusive, and that teaches the child that they are worthless, and they learn to try their best to please their parents, because the message is from the parents is that I will love you if you are a good boy or girl. So love is not unconditional, it's conditional. So the child learns to grow up in that kind of environment where love is conditional, they need to take care of someone else, they have very low self-esteem.
So, you know, one of the things that you talk about in your work as it relates to codependency is, you know, because you help people recover from this. So you talk about the ultimate purpose of recovery is actually to discover who we really are. So can you dive into that with us?
Sure, I can. Like I said, if you grow up in a dysfunctional family, you don't, basically you never find out who you are. You're identity is tied up with taking care of your parents and staying out of the way and being a good boy or girl. And being a good boy or girl means adapting to what they want all the time. You also, if you think about it, people grow up in a certain kind of neighborhood. They grow up in a certain kind of ethnicity. They grow up in a certain country. All of these factors are trying to shape the child to be what I would call a good member of society or a good member of the family, or short a cog in the machine, the social machine. And society really doesn't like individuals that much because individuals tend to think for themselves and they tend to think critically. I don't mean critical in the sense of negative, but evaluating things for themselves. And they know who they are, so they don't let themselves be led astray. And they live according to their own internal machine. That's the wrong word for soul, basically. And so when you grow up in a dysfunctional family, all of these good things are missing. You grow up to be a cog in the machine, and you don't know who you are. That happens to millions of people. And the work of recovery, we'll get to this in a minute. There's basically two stages. Do you want me to?
Sure.
Well, if recovery, especially for recovering alcoholics and addicts, is because they're so damaged and dysfunctional when they first get into recovery, I know I was, that the first job is to overcome all of that dangerous, risk-taking, addictive, dysfunctional behavior and learn to become a functioning member of society, not beholden to their addiction. And that is basically stage one. And when I say a functioning member of society, I mean, you're no longer on the outskirts, you know, you're no longer on the margins, you're part and parcel of society. But all too often, it also means functional means, you know, functioning as a social cog in the societal machine. And unfortunately, the recovery literature, and here people might not love me about this, but the big book basically says, that's it, you're done. That's the end of recovery. The big book was written 3 years after Bill Wilson got sober. So basically he was in early recovery. What we're finding is that after a number of years, and I don't know when, 5, 10, 15, 20 years, what happens is that deep, deep damage that's down in the unconscious that happened when you were a child starts to erupt. It starts to make itself known through depression, usually through deep, deep depression. But I got a very short story for you. I used to go to adult children of alcoholics religiously. I still attend sometimes. And I was at a meeting and there was a new guy there. And I went up to him after the meeting. He was very bluntly old. He was probably late 70s, early 80s, which shocked me. I've never seen that before. And I went and talked to him. And we got talking, and it turned out he had 50 years of recovery in Alcoholics Anonymous. And I said, well, what brings you here? He said, well, all those years, I was a big book thumper, you know, running workshops, the steps and all of that. And 6 months ago, I had a complete and total nervous breakdown. I landed in the mental hospital for for 3 months.
Wow.
And they told me, get your butt to adult children of alcoholics and do it right now. So he entered stage two recovery. His trauma issues started to surface and kicked his butt.
Mm-hmm. Can you clarify something for me, just in case people don't know? You referenced a couple times the Big Book, and for, you know, since this event is for obviously people, adult children of alcoholics or addicts or alcoholics themselves or codependents who aren't alcoholics. Could you explain what that is?
Yes, the Big Book is a kind of reverential term for the book that's titled actually Alcoholics Anonymous. And it is considered as the basic text for how to recover from alcoholism. It was written in 1938 or 1939, and it has gone through many, many revisions, but overall it's remained the same since then. So it gives you the basic formula for what I call stage one recovery.
Got it. Thank you. I appreciate that. You know, one thing that comes up when you mention this, right, first stage and next stage is it because, you know, I am not an addict or an alcoholic, but my father was an alcoholic, died an alcoholic. So I too am an adult child of an alcoholic. And is it that this next stage, all this stuff comes up that people who are drinking or doing drugs are covering up with that addiction, like all those emotions and traumas? Is that how you Absolutely. Would explain it?
I think of alcoholism as self-medication. You know, it's a depressant. I remember my first drink, by the way, as clear as if I took it yesterday. And I remember when it hit my system, I felt liberated. I felt free and comfortable for the first time in my entire life. That's because it relieved me of the pain that I was carrying, temporarily, of course. And that's what set me on my journey to become an alcoholic. I said, this is for me, I love it. And so yeah, absolutely, it is self-medication.
Mm-hmm. Got it. Thank you. I appreciate you clarifying that. I was just curious if that's kind of what you meant. You know, an emotion that comes up frequently in when we think of the word codependency is shame, right? Yes. This comes up all the time. People are talking about shame, 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 shame spirals and, you know, cycles and all this kind of stuff. So why is shame such a common emotion that codependent people experience, and how would you say, like in your coaching, like how do you help people overcome that?
Shame and codependency to me are simply two sides of one coin. Shame isn't just a common emotion. It is the emotion at the core of codependency. When you grow up in a traumatic, abusive environment, you may not get it. They get the message explicitly, but you very certainly get it implicitly, is that you are worthless and you are completely unworthy of love. You are unworthy of good things. You are at the base a piece of CRAP. Mm-hmm. And that message goes deep, way deep in the soul, down deep. And it explains why people are always looking to get validation from someone else, because they're completely unable to validate themselves. So they attach themselves to somebody that looks like is going to validate them. All too often, that person is a narcissist and may at times validate them just enough to keep that person around, but at root is perpetuating the abuse. But shame is at the core of codependency, and it is why people look to get their identity from somebody else because theirs is so corroded and, yeah, it corroded at base. And look, it's a difficult emotion. I, at times in recovery, had to experience shame. I had to let it come up out of my psyche. And I felt like truly like I wanted to kill myself. And it's such a dark, black, ugly emotion. And it's like experiencing yourself as just a worthless, you know, nothing. But paradoxically, that's how you recover from it. You have to let it out. If you keep it inside, you'll never recover, and you may end up becoming an addict. Maybe alcoholic, maybe drug addict, maybe sex addict, maybe relationship addict, but because something, you'll need something to validate you. The way to recover is to let it out gradually and slowly with someone who's safe, who will love you as you are, and instead of replicating shame, will either literally or symbolically put their arms around you and say, you are okay just as you are. I love you just as you are.
Yes. Right. It's that, I don't remember who said this, right? The adage of the only way out is through, and going into that darkness and
yeah.
Allowing yourself to feel it and be aware of it. And yeah. Mm-hmm. And then, right, then we can recover, but we have to first get to that, allow that.
Yeah. And let it go finally. Yeah.
Right. So, thank you for diving into shame, because it's such an important topic. It's another thing that I think about shame, that in my own personal experience, shame can be addictive. Like in my experience, you know, I could be having disempowering thoughts, or, you know, those, no, you know, the ego chiming in by whatever word, right? That voice in your head telling you you're not good enough, right? And it's just been an experience of mine that it can be addictive to keep listening to that, you know, and not letting that go. It just seems to be like has that ever come up with you or with people you've coached or anything?
Yeah, it's pernicious. It's difficult. That's why I say it's such a difficult emotion. You know, if you're in 12-step groups, one of the steps is to make amends to people you've harmed. That's for getting rid of guilt. Guilt is feeling bad over something you did. But shame is feeling awful about who you are. And it's so much harder to get rid of. So I think really what you're experiencing, I wouldn't call it the addictive quality. I'd just say it's just really hard to let go of.
Mm-hmm.
And it helps to have somebody with you that can validate you in recovery as you are, so that you finally get that mirroring, I'm okay as I am.
Right. So let's dive a little bit into modeling, because, you know, obviously you had your own childhood traumas and I've had mine and everybody's had theirs on some level or another, right? So how does one, so for example, if someone grows up in a household with an alcoholic parent or in a codependent parent, right? One's an alcoholic, one's codependent. How is it that we as children end up taking on these behaviors, right? We see mom's a codependent, she's enabling dad. How is it that we end up becoming that because of what we've watched?
Well, I mean, it's kind of a simple thing. That's, parents are to children the equivalent of God. They take their God-like figures to the child. That, you know, if you come into recovery, and if you're in a 12-step recovery, you need to find a higher power of your own understanding. And for many people, many people, that's difficult because their image of God is basically the image of their parents, a nasty, vicious, angry person who's going to cast you into hell if you're not a good boy. Guess what? That's your parents. And children learn from their parents. That's their primary, unfortunately, that's their primary way they learn, is through their parents.
Mm-hmm. So how does one, if someone starts becoming aware of, wow, I have become like my mother, I have become like my father, what do you recommend they do to unbecome that, to actually figure out who they are and, you know, go down their own path?
In some form or fashion, they need to enter into recovery. That is different for every person, what that means for that person, but it could involve getting involved in a 12-step group if they're addicted to a substance. It could be AA, Alcoholics Anonymous, if they're addicted to other drugs. It could be Narcotics Anonymous. If they are just codependents, they could check out Codependents Anonymous or Adult Children of Alcoholics. Those are two separate. The former one is actually part of Al-Anon. It's called, what's that called?
I don't know.
Adult Children. I'll remember it in a minute. But the other one is ACA. Mm-hmm. Their website is adultchildren.org. And there are meetings here and there. There are also telephone meetings, internet-based meetings. I also suggest getting maybe a therapist or a coach, someone that you can talk with on a one-on-one basis, because I don't think you can do it by yourself. Mm-hmm. If you could, you probably already would have.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's been a common theme in talking with everyone on this event, how important it is to get support, whatever that whatever resonates with you and what that looks like, whether it's, you know, going and getting a coach like Dr. Rob, whether it's going to a meeting, physically being with people, getting a therapist, watching events like this, you know, any number of things, reading books, listening to podcasts.
Oh, you know. Books. I forgot about that. I must have read literally 100 books when I started getting into this stuff. My codependency in ACOA. Read books about shame. I read books about adult children. I also read books about the history of my religion so that I could deconstruct it, because it was so destructive to me. I needed to basically deconstruct it and reconstruct something entirely new. I discovered the work of Carl Jung, the Swedish psychiatrist, who for me is extremely powerful stuff. One of his statements that is like a mantra for me is, if you do not make the unconscious conscious, it will rule your life and you will call it fate.
Mm-hmm.
In other words, the stuff that's inside of you, you will reenact, but you will not realize that you are the source of the reenactment. It will look like things are happening to you. That's the fate part. And that's because you're not conscious of what you're doing. That's the problem with having everything in the unconscious. If you don't know about it, you literally can't see it. So you're like bumping around in the dark. And that's why you have to make the unconscious conscious.
Mm-hmm.
Take some work.
Yeah, I'm so glad you mentioned that, because that kind of goes down the path of taking personal responsibility, right? And, you know, we, again, no matter what our childhoods were, now we are adults and now we have a choice. And, you know, we have a choice to be responsible for this CRAP, as you put it, coming back up into our lives, this unresolved business, emotions, memories, all this kind of stuff. We do have a choice. And that's like one of the biggest things I want to give people with this event. I want to remind people of we are responsible and have a choice and we can recover. And no matter what, again, whatever walk of life you're in or whatever you were affected by, it is up to us and we can do it, you know, with the support of others.
Yes. You made me think of one thing. It's very important to me. And that is when you're in this type of recovery, anger is okay. In fact, rage is okay. You'll get the message that your parents did the best they could. Stop blaming them. Well, if I'm walking down the sidewalk and a truck runs over me and I scream out in pain and rage, is that blame or is that just experiencing what just happened? It's letting out what has been stuffed and stuffed and stuffed for all these years. It's not blame. In fact, it's the opposite. It's beginning to take responsibility because you're finally owning the fact that you have rage. I let it out. It's a paradox.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, no, that's a really good point. And yeah, absolutely. Having some kind of way to release your anger in a healthy way, right? All the different things one can do, screaming in their car on the way down the road, you know, screaming into the pillows and, all sorts of different ways that we can exercise, you know, all sorts of things.
Yeah. In my therapist's office, several times, I've been a very frightening man. My therapist worked with people in trauma. So he just sat there and listened and heard back to me that I was lovable and it was just so liberating.
Well, let's dive into that a little bit. So obviously self-love is a big issue with codependents, you know, having struggles of loving themselves and hence they become codependent. So can you talk a little bit about how do you help people learn to love themselves?
Well, I think that learning to love yourself is sort of a multi-pronged thing that, like, not loving yourself started with the, you know, funhouse distorted mirror that was your parents or caregivers that reflected back to you that you are not lovable. So one mode of doing it is to add people to your life that let you know that you are lovable. Friends in recovery, a coach, maybe a sponsor for some people, maybe a therapist, but somebody who consistently, and that's an important term, consistently, over time, mirrors back to you that you are loved and lovable just as you are. And I think another avenue is reading. You know, once you start really understanding what happened to you, it's like cracking open this thick lid of stuff that you've hidden, stuffed, and it can come out. And as you release those toxins, you'll begin to realize they were just toxins. They weren't real. They weren't me. And underneath all those toxins and shame is the real me. And I am lovable just as I am. Some people need to find a loving God that can reflect back to them that you are loved and you are saved just as you are without any need for change. You can be imperfect. In fact, one of the messages, I forgot this, of a dysfunctional family is that, and this is why perfectionism is so prevalent among codependents, is that love is conditional. So children try to be perfect, thinking they're going to earn love. And since you're never perfect, that means you're worthless. And as you start to embrace your, what I call your essential imperfection, or what I call sometimes brokenness, and you just being human, you know, then you start to realize that you're lovable, you're acceptable, you're a good person, and I deserve what everybody else deserves, and God loves me, and I love me, and other people love me. It happens over time. I don't know if that makes sense to you.
Oh, yeah. And I'm glad you brought up the perfectionistic qualities that so many of us as codependents have, and relating it back to the unconditional love, right? It makes perfect sense. And I mean, I love that you keep bringing it back to that, right? Drawing a connection between your past and then getting a better understanding of it now, because once you start doing that, and as I continue to do that in my journey, a journey that continues over years and years and years, right? It never ends. It's those are the moments when it's like, oh, it makes perfect sense now. Why am I such a perfectionist? Oh,
yeah. You'll have a million revelations along the way. Isn't it wonderful?
Yes, it certainly is.
So many ahas. Yeah.
I love it. Thank you. I'm so glad you brought that up. So another thing you talk about in the topic of codependency is something called individuation. Can you talk about what that is?
Sure. It's sort of a long word, and it is basically the direct opposite, 180 degrees away from codependency. Codependency is wrapping yourself around another person, taking your identity off of something or someone else. And that could, like I said, include your ethnic group, you know, what society you're growing up. There's all these factors to try to mold who you are so you fit in, because that's what they want. Individuation is undoing all that and discovering what I call a God-given identity. My personal belief, and it may be false, I don't know, but my belief is that God created each person to be who they are, and that each person is absolutely unique in some way, shape, or form, maybe only in small ways, but the work is to discover who that is and begin to express it. And you know, align your life around it. There's a guy I work with that was an electrical engineer, and after about 20 years in recovery, he started realizing that that was an adaptation that he adopted to stay away from his feelings, because it's, you know, it's from here up. And what he really was an artist. He went back to art school and, you know, became an artist. That is an example. It doesn't have to be that dramatic, but it is embracing who you are and fulfilling who you are. I think that unfolding process of the identity and living it out well into over our entire lifespan is really what life is all about and what recovery is all about. Mm-hmm. Covering our real gifts inside. But I just want to call it inner gold, because I believe God doesn't make junk.
It's all gold, everybody.
It's all gold. Broken gold, the gold.
Right. Well, I'm glad you mentioned that story about the electrical engineer, I think you said, because I see that in myself. I see in a lot of people choosing to choose a career that ends up being very intellectual in order to avoid, yes, that maybe more creative, intuitive, you know, side of us. And yeah, that's a good point. It reminds me of when I get really deep into figuring out technology and websites, which I can be really good at, but it's definitely not, it's not my inner gold. I just can, you know, I can spend a lot of time figuring things out, but then it's like, wait a second, what do I really want to be doing with my time?
Yeah. Well, I did it too. When I talked about my master's, but those were relatively recent. When I got out of high school and went directly into college, I got a bachelor's degree in mathematics and a master's degree in statistics.
Mm.
What was I doing? I was running from my feelings as fast as I could. That's what I was doing.
Mm-hmm.
Answers. It was clear. It was orderly. It was peaceful. There's no chaos in any of it. And so it was safe. But when I went to work, I gradually started realizing I loathed it.
Mm-hmm.
And it took me many, many years of trying bumping around, finding out who I really am until I discovered this.
Right. Yeah. And all that being said, anyone watching right now whose actual inner gold path, we could call it, is to obviously do statistics, mathematics, engineering, whatever it is, obviously, yes. You know, you're like my 10-year-old stepdaughter, Ava, who knows what she'll become, right? Or how many different things she'll become, but it's clear her mind tends to operate in a very engineering type way. So wouldn't surprise us if she became something like that. But yeah, but yeah, we all have our own path.
Yeah, there's a guy I work with who grew up as a farmer. And in recovery, after a number of years, he went back to school to study mechanical engineering because that's real. He just adores it, you know. Mm-hmm. And so, yeah, absolutely.
Mm-hmm. Awesome. So switching gears just a little bit here, this is a question that I've been asking a lot of people. Because it's you know, another common, right, trait, characteristic of people who are codependent are they're controlling, they can be controlling and manipulative, right, to get what they want and that kind of stuff. So what do you recommend for people on how to overcome being controlling and manipulative?
Yeah, that's a tough one, isn't it? That's because they're trying to get from the other person what they can't give themselves. You know, the validation, it may be financial. Codependents don't learn. It's the weirdest thing. Codependent families, everybody's trying to take care of everybody else, but nobody's taking care of themselves.
Mm-hmm.
So you grow up looking for somebody to take care of you. And that puts you in a dependent position, and it may be subtle, it may be unconscious, but when you are in a dependent position, that means you must control and manipulate other people to get what you need. Maybe seductively, maybe cruelly, you know, there's a thousand ways to do it, but if you unable to take care of yourself or unable to validate yourself, you're dependent on other people, and you have to make them in some form or fashion give you what you need.
Mm-hmm. Right. So maybe everyone watching right now, if you tend to be controlling or manipulative, like take a look and see if that is you, right? Are you doing these things, being controlling, because you're really just trying to validate yourself and, you know, do that inner exploration?
Yeah, the first step in moving past it is becoming aware of it. Like I said, if you're not aware of it, if you're unconscious, you're just going to... But if you start becoming aware of it, then you can start at least to take steps. And that typically is a very, very long and often very painful process. It might involve becoming financially responsible for yourself. It might mean letting go of your spouse. I don't mean physically, but in some sense, detaching from them and recovering for yourself, going to meetings, even though your spouse doesn't really like it. you have to move away from the dependent position to some form of independence, and then ultimately to interdependence, if, big if, the other party is willing to grow with you.
Mm-hmm. So could you take a moment to say what that means, interdependence? Obviously, this is a term that's thrown around a lot in the codependency world too. What is interdependence?
Sure. I think of marriage or partnership between two people, lifelong commitment. There's actually three parties. There's me, there's you, and there's we. And what that means is, okay, when people are not in recovery, there's no I, there's no me, there's just we. There's that total enmeshment in each other. That's the essence of codependency, is a very, very deep enmeshment where each party in some form or fashion takes their identity off the other person, is taking care of the other person. They're lost in the relationship. And the second step, or actually the first step, is to begin to individuate out of that enmeshment, that sort of like this thing, and find your own separate identity, discover who you are apart from the other person. And if they're willing and able to grow with you, eventually to discover those parts that you share, you know, where you each have your separate identities, things you do, let's say, on your own. You don't feel the need to be around your spouse all, you know, 24 hours a day. And they don't need to be around you, controlling and watching you 24 hours a day. Each person has their own thing, but they also have shared things. Maybe they go hiking together. Maybe they love to go to movies and plays together. I mean, it could be a million things, but each person, there's an I, and there's a you, there's a me, and there's a we. Mm. Dependence is the we part.
Got it. Thank you. I appreciate you clarifying that. Awesome. There's so much good stuff to let soak in and absorb. Since we're running a little low on time here, Dr. Rob, I want to make sure that I ask you, where can everyone learn more about you and your work?
Oh, absolutely. I'm glad you brought that up. And Dr. Rob, I can be reached. I'll actually give you my telephone number. My office number is 908-757-4721. Let me repeat that, 908-757-4721. My cell is 908-922-3009. I'll repeat that also, 908-922-3009. I did that because I hate it when people leave their telephone numbers on voicemail and they say it at a million miles an hour. It's a message like 10 times. My email is Dr. Rob, DRROBB, two R's and two B's, at nextstagerecovery.com. My website is www.nextstagerecovery.com. I have a Facebook page. I think it's Facebook/Next Stage Recovery. I also have a Twitter account, but I can't think of it. I'm not an electronic person. And those are the primary ways to get a hold of me.
Well, and just to remind everybody, we're going to actually have a link, and now I'll actually add in your phone number, your email address, Facebook link, and I'll get your Twitter link before this airs. and make sure that that is below the video when you're watching it. Everybody see you can just click through on Dr. Rob's pages, check out his website, give him a ring on his cell or his home number, office number, and or any communicate whatever way that you'd like. So thank you for sharing, and I appreciate all the work you're doing in the world. Is there any last and final insights you want to share before we hop off, Dr. Rob?
A vision for you. You can recover. This is doable. There was a long period of time where we didn't understand it. Now we do. And there are finally recovery tools and groups and all kinds of supports for recovery from codependency. I don't care how far down the scale you think you are, you can recover. And I would strongly urge you to move into recovery. Don't give up. Never, never, never give up.
Yes, and as Dr. Rob mentioned before we started this interview, that sign right behind his head in this interview says exactly what he just said.
Yep.
It's a good reminder. Never, never, never give up. Thank you, Dr. Rob. I really appreciate all of your time and work. All right. All right, everybody. Thanks for tuning in. And here is to our collective journey to self-love and healthy relationships. Bye, everybody.
Bye-bye.
Hey, everyone. I just got off a great interview with Dr. Dean Robb. He shed so much light on this topic of codependency and gave me personally so many insights and things to think about and apply in my own life. And I hope you as well. A couple of the things that really stood out for me were when he talked about perfectionism. So I don't know how many people listening right now or watching right now are perfectionists or would call themselves that, but I certainly am. And it's definitely been something that's been kind of debilitating in my life. And it comes from this codependent nature that I've experienced and continue to experience in my life and continue to work on. And I thought that what was really eye-opening was when he talked about how it stems from not being loved unconditionally as a kid. So this was a big aha moment for me. So I kind of wanted to touch on it again with you, just in case it's also an aha for you. If you weren't loved unconditionally as a kid, perhaps you are now a perfectionist because you just keep trying to be this perfect thing, this perfect human, when the reality is we're all imperfect or perfect in our imperfections, and we're all just being human. So some food for thought. Another thing that I really love that Dr. Rob talked about was it's okay to let out that anger. If you are experiencing anger and things are coming up for you in your journey of recovering from codependency, it's okay to feel it. Allow yourself to feel it. Find healthy ways to release that anger. You know, I mentioned on the interview, you know, screaming into a pillow or driving down the road and you're screaming down the road and in your car when really no one's paying attention to you, those kinds of things. Whatever works for you. Maybe you want to take up boxing. Maybe you're, you know, want to do a lot of exercise or, you know, things to get out that anger. But just be aware that it's okay to have it, it's okay to feel it, and it's okay to release it in these healthy ways. Third thing I wanted to touch on was the word interdependence. This is probably maybe a word that you've heard in the world of codependency. So interdependence. Dr. Rob talked about how there is a you, there's a me, and there's a we. So in your recovery from codependency, right, it's important to be focusing in on you, right? Who are you as an individual? What are the things that you like to do, that you love to do, that make you who you are, right? Your characteristics, your traits, your passions, your joys, your dislikes, your likes, all those kinds of things. Really hone in on who you are. And then, of course, there's your partner or maybe a future partner of yours if you don't have a partner right now, and who they are. And then there's we, right? Then there's the things that we like to do together, the things we have in common, the things we can support each other in. So that's that interdependence that Dr. Rob was talking about. All right, I just wanted to do that quick recap. Thanks again for tuning into this installment of Overcoming Codependency, and we'll see you on the next interview. Thanks, everybody.